From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In writing about bygone historical eras, scholars and literary historians often find parallels with contemporary ideas and social questions. The Middle Ages in Europe, the period roughly spanning the years between 500 and 1500 AD, are a case in point. Where, in modern ways of thinking and seeing the world around us, do scholars find analogies that reflect the days of Geoffrey Chaucer and the society he inhabited? How do these parallels express themselves today? Soundings now presents the second segment in a series of discussions about medieval English literature and society. The panelists are four scholars of the English Middle Ages: Judson Allen, David Benson, Judith Furster, and Mary Tavormina. Judson Allen teaches at the University of Florida, David Benson at the University of Connecticut, Judith Furster at Brandeis University, and Mary Tavormina at Michigan State University. Professors Benson, Furster, and Tavormina have all completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where each worked on books about medieval English literature.
Now, Judson Allen was saying a moment ago that in spite of this sort of categorization that exists in medieval society, people attempted to be whole individuals, to have a complete sense of themselves. Was there anything the equivalent of what we would call psychology, in the sense that people talked to one another and figured out what drove them, and apart from religion, for instance? I mean, can you talk in secular terms?
I think there was what we call, for lack of a better term, courtly love. Is a very elaborate analysis of the feelings that one has, and their feelings that teenagers still have when they get into a condition of absolute desire and absolute adoration of an absolutely unattainable woman.
David?
And yet one of the difficulties, I think, with modern attempts to understand courtly love, and this has been one of the most vexed questions in medieval studies, is that courtly love to a great degree seems to take its vocabulary from the vocabulary of religious love. And the degree to which this is to be taken seriously, to the degree which this is simply borrowing the vocabulary that is there at the time.
Now, Judson Allen is shaking his head no. Why is that?
I think those commentaries on Canticles that to which I'm sure you're referring owe as much to the courtly lyric as courtly lyric owes to them.
Now, let me stop you for a moment. When you're talking about courtly love and the courtly lyric, is there today a social counterpart for this device or phenomenon? And maybe I'm trivializing, but I'm thinking about the lyrics of popular songs.
It's entirely true, yes. You can find every motif of courtly love in any Hit Songs magazine.
David?
Well, I think one of the great difficulties in interpreting courtly love, or perhaps even country and western music, is the degree to which those motifs, a lot of which are traditional, a lot of which are, as in some of the examples that Judson Allen cited, done not perhaps because of their truth, but because they're funny, they're witty, they can make an interesting story, to the degree to which these are really reflecting any kind of social reality. And again, this is one of the great debates about courtly love. This certainly is something that we call courtly love in literature. The degree to which this reflects real life is a very great question. And the analogy that always occurs to me is the one with Agatha Christie. If a few hundred years from now, we knew that Agatha Christie was one of the most popular novelists in the 20th century and tried to reconstruct society from her popular novels, we would come up with the conclusion that there was a lot of murder going on in England among the upper classes, which we know isn't true, but they wouldn't.
Judith?
I think one analogy with courtly language in the Middle Ages is flirting now. And some of the medieval...
You mean the practice of flirting?
Yeah, and some medieval texts give commentaries on exactly this problem of the relationship between a kind of artificial discourse and life. In Gawain and the Green Knight, the lady tries to seduce Gawain partly by saying, "Let's play at it. I know you can teach me about the language of love." And when he proves recalcitrant, she says, "Well, let me teach you." And it's a real seduction, which in order to get out of, he tries to treat merely as play. And I have a sense that in modern flirting, there is often some ambiguity about whether we're playing or whether we're serious. And sometimes there are great misunderstandings because some people who like to flirt don't mean anything by it, and some people do.
How were women looked upon in the Middle Ages? From a literary standpoint, for instance, what does Chaucer have to say?
Chaucer has a lot to say about women, and part of what you can see is that your status as a woman is also dependent on your status, your class status. So to be an aristocratic woman in Chaucer is sometimes to be the pawn of political or financial dealings. To be a middle-class woman is sometimes actually to have more freedom and more power.
Judson?
I think we need to remember that there were, in the Middle Ages, enormously powerful women, such as Eleanor d'Aquitaine, who married the King of France and was divorced for not being able to have suitable male children, and who then proceeded to have with the King of England a number of very suitable male children, including Richard the Lionhearted. She owned vast tracts of France. She was a sovereign in her own right, and to marry her was to marry an enormous prize.
How would you characterize political power in the England of the Middle Ages? Tess?
Well, I think one of the aspects of medieval politics that we forget is the personal quality of it. And we were speaking earlier of the familial nature of the king's court. There's a sense in which the king's court is not a place you go to work and then go home. It is your home in many ways, and you are working for people to whom you have personal obligations, not merely contractual ones.
Judith.
The other thing to say about political power in the Middle Ages is that there is here too a theory and a practice that doesn't always conform to the theory. The theory was very clearly laid out and it was top down. So the theory was very clear, but it wasn't always followed, and more in the Middle Ages you got both practice in which people in the lower strata had something to say about their own lives and could pass ideas up, and a theory which then developed to justify this. So there was more and more interest. You might not exactly call it democracy, but at least more and more interest in the way that the ruled have some sort of validity or authority as well as the rulers.
Well, now, you just used the word democracy, Judith. Who criticized political power in the Middle Ages in English society? Was there anybody to stand sort of aside or back from it and say, this is wrong, this needs to be fixed? How did all of that work? David?
Lots of people did, and I think perhaps as far as the great English poets of the 14th century, John Gower is a very good example in his Confessio Amantis, and he takes these different divisions of the realm. He takes the commons, he takes the church, he takes rulers, and he finds things wrong with all of them. And he sees all of them not living up to their ideals. And again, I think this is a big difference from the modern world. The modern world, when we find things not living up to ideals, we begin to wonder whether the ideals perhaps are not right. Perhaps we ought to change our views of sexual morality or our views of drinking or driving, because people do not seem to be acting in the way that they had agreed on in the past. It seems from Gower, and I think from other medieval people, that the call is always to go back to those ideals, and always never to think that those ideals themselves need to be changed, but that people individually and as groups need to live up to the ideals.
Judson?
Two complicating factors. One is that since there was no police force, since there was no really effective means of making people behave most of the time, a good deal of government was carried on by consent, in the sense that you went by precedent, you sued rather than fought, because the alternative, total chaos, was unthinkable. Now, another factor is that there was in the Middle Ages, there were in the Middle Ages not one government, but two. There was the church, there was the secular authority, whether it be expressed in dukedoms, counties, kingdoms, or what have you. And I think the perfect modern analogy is the relation between nation states and multinational corporations. each of which has its own interests, each of which functions in a sense as a government, as a power, and there is constant pulling and hauling between Exxon and the United States as to which one shall be right about what.
Let me ask you to comment about a specific sort of social proposition. You're talking about comparisons with nation states, medieval society, and the way we live in the 20th century. What were families like? You talked a moment ago, for instance, Judson, about authority and the consensus of how a society should live. Is the family important there?
I wouldn't call it the family. I would call it the household.
Mm-hmm.
People sent their children to the households of their social superiors to be educated, and to be educated meant that they functioned as servants in increasingly more responsible positions, from polishing pots in the kitchen to carving before their fathers at the table to being in charge of this manor house or that operation. So a household might include numbers of people living, as it were, in the same family who are not blood kin.
Were marriages arranged consistent with that sort of social arrangement? The one wealthy parent would say to another wealthy parent, we need to keep the land together, how did all of that work?
They looked at the, shall we say, capital involved and made a marriage arrangement designed to enhance its value and enhance its continuity.
Now, what tension would that have had with all of this that you were saying a few moments ago about courtly love? Which is to say the individual impulse, Tess?
There are tensions between the patterns of household in the upper classes and in the lower classes, which often did have relatively small numbers of people in them. What we would consider, in fact, nuclear families can be found in the villages, possibly one serving maid if a peasant family was fairly well off. But on the whole, parents and then children, generally not much more extended than that. As you move into more wealthy classes, then you begin to have the more complex households. Now, when you look at arranged marriages, though, you certainly find that at all levels. People want to make good marriages for their children, no matter what level they're at, and they try to make it within their class because those are generally the people that you can expect to be willing to marry their kid to your kid. This, however, gets into tension with perhaps with courtly love at the level of people who are aware of that, but even more so with the church's view that marriage is based on the consent of the two individuals and only on that consent, and that the family has nothing to say about it. So the church is busy supporting a rather individualized notion of marriage where just I want to marry you and you want to marry me is all that counts. And a family and village and sort of general social network theory of marriage in which marriage is something which is going to affect all your kin, your friends, so on. It's going to affect how the property descends and who you're going to be working with for the rest of your life. And that's a tension which I think less attention is paid to than the tension between, say, courtly love and arranged marriages, which would have affected, I think, fewer people in the mm-hmm. society.
Judson?
Tess, back to your point about arranged marriages taking place fairly low down, I think Chaucer gives us a wonderful illustration in the Reeves tale, in which the householder, the miller, is married to the daughter of the parish priest. Now, one needs to wonder how that happened, and he considers this an incredible status plum on his part that he has managed to acquire such an aristocratic lady. And their daughter is being very carefully preserved so that she can marry well. The tale is a narrative of how this preservation is foiled.
What about that, Tess?
Well, the parish priest offers a couple of advantages. For one thing, the parish priest is always free, whether he was born a peasant or not, a villain. He becomes free by being a priest, and presumably even an illegitimate child of the parish priest is freeborn, whereas a reeve or a miller is generally not. And on the other hand, parish priests could accumulate wealth, personal individual wealth, just as modern secular priests can, and might well have quite a bit to pass on to his daughter.
Judith Furster.
We haven't mentioned, when we're talking about psychology and ways of understanding human behavior, we haven't mentioned three important systems for understanding that in the Middle Ages, and those were astrology, the stars, the humors, the system of humors, and also the a scholastic idea that the human being was made up of will, memory, and reason or intellect. And
how important were these things? Were they social conventions that that got into the social consciousness and fabric, David?
Some of them are extremely important. For example, although there's some debate about this, a lot of medieval medical manuals talk about the importance of astrology, making medicines at the right astrological time, applying them at the right astrological time.
Is it fair for us to call this ignorant superstition?
Not at all. And it seems to me that those structures are very much like, analogically, the Freudian id, ego, and superego. It gives you a way of interpreting the things you experience. And it's not so important, in a sense, as to what the labels are as that you have a set of labels. Mm-hmm. Or to go back to the notion of the seven sins, this is a set of categories, and everything is going to go in somewhere. Perhaps the practical side of the seven sins interpretation of the world comes out in the confessional. It gives you a way of understanding motives, as Courtly Love gives you a way of understanding motives. As if you're going to be a physician, you have a way of understanding what to do in a given sickness.
Judson?
Medieval medicine, in a sense, was more holistic than our medicine has been until very recent times. We can talk about hormone imbalances and biochemical problems directly connected to the emotional status and state of the person involved. And when medieval people talked about the humors, to be bilious, to be choleric, to be sanguine, and so forth, they were talking about psychosomatic states of the human organism.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second segment in a series of conversations about medieval English literature and society. The Soundings panelists are Judson Allen of the University of Florida, David Benson of the University of Connecticut, Judith Furster of Brandeis University, and Mary Tavormina of Michigan State University. Here is Judith Furster.
It's also important to say about the astrology that it feeds into a couple of very important intellectual issues. When you're trying to explain somebody's behavior and you play around with whether it was the stars or whether it's a superficial cop-out to blame the stars, because really they're responsible and they had a choice about what they were going to do about, say, they have a tendency toward anger or toward lust because of their horoscope.
No, when you say they, you mean the people.
The people, yeah, say, right. If you're trying to explain an individual's behavior, the wife of Beth tries to explain herself and by saying, I was born under these stars and therefore I have these tendencies. But she puts it very ambiguously, I followed my inclination because of my constellation. What is the relationship between the individual response to the givens? And so what we're talking about is free will and determinism, which is a very important theological issue in that period. And the astrological issue feeds right into the theological problem, which are individuals responsible for what they do in a Christian culture where people are saved or punished according to what they do? That's a very important issue.
David?
Maybe just to add to that, to give some sense of the complexity of medieval culture, is that astrology, quite apart from everything that Judith has said, which is all quite true, astrology was also a way that the Middle Ages had of preserving a lot of classical lore. And so they looked at the stars. They no longer believed in the classical gods, but they talked about the planets with their classical names, and it was a way of keeping classical lore and not saying, well, the classical period was all wrong. They were totally stupid. It was a way of co-opting that also.
Judson.
And it was an instrument of psychological analysis, just as we find it profitable to talk about id, ego, superego. We find it profitable to talk about whether we are Aries or Virgo or Pisces or what have you. Even believing that the stars have no influence whatsoever, being willing to believe that the kind of person I am is important to my behavior. I must understand the kind of person I am. Whether you call it predestination, whether you call it Freudian determinism, whatever you call it, it is a demand that a human being, in order to behave properly, understand himself. in terms of all the forces that impinge on him and make him what he is. The point is not that some things are good, some things are bad. The point is that there is a tremendous pressure of the normative in medieval literature. People tell stories knowing what behavior is proper, what behavior is improper, and there's an enormous sense that one is playing these particular facts off against a well-known backboard, a well-known norm.
Mm-hmm. Judith?
I think that's true, but it seems to me that there's also a great self-awareness about the ability. What you say is true for authors presenting norms, but it seems also true that there is a great power in the reader to take it correctly or take it wrongly, so that in the Middle Ages, it seems to me there's a lot of self-awareness about the reader's interpretation as well as the writer's intention, and that is particularly sensitive, I think, in the late Middle Ages when people were actually reading more. We've talked about how people get their literature by hearing it read aloud, but when they're reading it, they're taking it home, and they're not close to the author anymore, and they can't see his gestures, and they can't hear his irony. They can interpret it for themselves. The most famous example, of course, is Paolo and Francesca in Canto 5 of Dante's Inferno, where the book, if you read the whole of it, shows you the disaster that can come from adultery. And Paolo and Francesca, instead of reading the whole book, only read up to the Lancelot and Guinevere's kiss, imitate the adultery and are damned for it. And it's not just that episode in Dante, it's not just showing that literature can lead you astray, but rather that you can lead yourself astray using literature, interpreting it the way you want.
Let's conclude. I want you to reflect on the English medieval society and literature. You may want to talk in terms of large social analogies. You may want to talk in personal terms. Why do you read this stuff? What brings you to it, and what do you take from it? What do you find interesting and rewarding about looking at the Middle Ages? Judson?
My wife tells me that when I chose my field back many years ago, I became a medievalist because medievalists have to go to Europe, and I wanted to go to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a certain sense of handling relics and dealing with the manuscripts firsthand. And I think that medievalists find, because there are so many manuscripts that have not been edited or even cataloged, that there is real work to be done from square one. And that it's very enjoyable to go to a library and get a book in which you may, by turning a page, make a real discovery out of a book that no one has looked at since 1400. I think in a larger sense, I see the Middle Ages as the period in which I should think in order to think most profitably about my own time. If you look at the little village of San Gimignano in Italy from a distance, it is a little collection of towers on a hilltop. If you look at Manhattan from a distance, it is a collection of towers. The difference is that the towers of San Gimignano were owned by noblemen, and the towers in Manhattan are owned by corporations. And there is the significant difference that all the rich people of modern times are legal abstractions called corporations, and this makes a difference. At the same time, the nobility we call corporations and they called counts or dukes or what have you, who build their country houses, who build their towers, who express their presence architecturally, it's an analogy that is profitable. And I think that as the Renaissance looked back to classical Rome, we are increasingly and with greater profit looking back to the Middle Ages in order to find the model of our future.
Tess Tavormina.
Let me pick up on the comparison of the past with the future. One of the interesting things, an interesting phenomenon that one often discovers is that people who are interested in the Middle Ages are often interested in science fiction as well, perhaps less among medievalists than among our students. Creative anachronists often are computer buffs. There's an interesting connection, I think, between the past and the future in that they both look at another way the world might be. And that gives a way then of thinking about the world that is, of criticizing it, of thinking about changing it, of perhaps seeing its positive aspects as well. And so, in a sense, to look at the past really is to imagine what might be changed about the present.
David?
I think the idea of an alternate world, which is something that I think most of our students don't have, most of our students have very little sense of history. When they think of the Middle Ages, they often think that the Middle Ages are Victorians in slightly different dress. And I think one of the nice things about the Middle Ages is to present a very different world, as Tess said, so that we can therefore judge that some of the things we do are not absolutely necessary, and that some of the things we do might even be wrong. But I think what makes the Middle Ages particularly interesting compared to, say, the classical period or a closer period like the 18th century is, on the one hand, they are closer to us than perhaps classical people are in some way. So many institutions like the university we've inherited from them, so many ideas that are still around today, so many values like romantic love and honor, if they didn't begin in the Middle Ages, certainly have a power from the Middle Ages that we're still drawing on. And yet, even though we have these close associations with the Middle Ages, we're also different from them. It is the general conception to think of the modern world as beginning in the Renaissance, and in some way that's true. And the Middle Ages provides the closest period that is really quite significantly different from us. And I think when you read medieval literature, you find in many ways you feel that you're reading someone who feels very close, who feels very familiar, who feels very much like you, and then suddenly you come up against something that seems completely different. And it's that tension between the two that's so often exciting.
Judith?
I chose the Middle Ages because of the modern discourse that was going on about it when I was starting out. I don't think I had that sense of attraction to the old for its own sake, but because it was so hard to understand. When I was beginning graduate school, there was a lot of conflict about how to interpret medieval literature, and the fact that something that had been around for so long was being argued about in such a lively way is what drew me to it in the first place. I stay because it seems to me that it grows with me. Whatever I learn intellectually or emotionally, I find answered in the texts. So I find them rich, inexhaustible, and fascinating for that reason.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the second segment in a series of discussions about medieval English literature and society. The panelists for Soundings were Judson Allen of the University of Florida, David Benson of the University of Connecticut, Judith Furster of Brandeis University, and Mary Tavormina of Michigan State University. Subsequent Soundings programs will present discussions about other aspects of literature and society during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr. The Soundings panelists will be two of Dr. King's biographers, David Lewis of Howard University and David Garrow of the City College of New York. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part two of a conversation about medieval English literature and society. In writing about the Middle Ages, scholars and literary historians often find parallels with contemporary ideas and social questions. How do these parallels express themselves today? A panel of scholars from the University of Connecticut, Michigan State University, the University of Florida, and Brandeis University has some answers and insights. Medieval English Literature and Society, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.